Welcome to On Demand with Jenna Ellis. This is our AFR exclusive podcast where we answer your questions, do deep dives on the issues that you want to hear about most with the guests that you love here on demand. And I was doing the little, you know, Trump dance to that music. I think that actually kind of works to that theme song. But Trump is the topic, of course, today, because with so many of his flurry of nominees, we did a deep dive into at least what he had announced as of a couple of weeks ago. But there's been so much more since then. So we thought we would do another deep dive, particularly on the Department of Justice, and then looking ahead to potential Supreme Court nominees and kind of get into the legal weeds with our very dear friend, Ron Coleman, who is an attorney, and he is the host of the Coleman Nation podcast. So, you know, Ron, I'm actually really excited about Pam Bondi, who is the nominee for Attorney General. She's been a good friend of mine for years, just, you know, full disclosure. And I think she's excellent. She was an excellent Florida Attorney General until she was term limited. She's been a Trump supporter for a really long time. And then, of course, your law partner, Harmeet Dhillon, was nominated for Deputy Attorney General in the in the Civil Rights Division. I think that is a phenomenal appointment. So let's talk DOJ. These nominees, your perspective, and what really needs to change with this Department of, to get it back really to the Department of Justice, not the Department of Injustice, as it has been during Biden.
Well, great to talk to you, Jenna, and thanks for having me on. I just want to make something really clear that I don't think anyone who's smart enough to listen to your show needs to be reminded, but I really think it's important that people remember that even though we're talking about the Supreme Court and we're talking about the Department of Justice, those are two different branches of government. The Department of Justice, as you know, is part of the executive branch. And it is not it's not supposed to have some kind of independence. I mean, obviously, every person who works in the executive branch is duty-bound to honor the Constitution. No one's supposed to be a hitman. We don't pledge an oily loaf. That write that one down, folks. That's their opening for the Clash in Atlanta.
That's going to be my new GIF for Ron Coleman. Yeah, but you know, you can continue.
loyalty. But having said that, what we have had is a Justice Department, as you well know, and of course this has also been a theme that has happened at the state level, as you have been victimized by yourself. Law enforcement in executive branch has become part of highly unconstitutional deprivation of civil rights operation. Pam Bondi, who I don't know nearly as well as you do, but who I worked with in Philadelphia in 2020 and got to know a little bit, is indeed a fantastic choice. I tweeted about her after working with her. At one point, we were in the convention center trying to get the legal access that Pennsylvania law entitled us to observe the counting of mail-in ballots, and someone suggested some sort of a trick that we would perhaps pull that would get us in an extra-legal manner. And Pam said, "No, that's not how we operate. We're the good guys. We're going to do this right. That's exactly what we're all about." And I know that listening to this. And this is something that I sometimes do, now they call it engagement farming, but in order to get a discussion going on X, if I make that kind of statement, don't become what you abhor, don't become what you despise. People will say, you see, you're a rhino, you're the same kind of feckless Republican, you're not willing to fight, they're willing to fight. No, that's how you get Bolsheviks. Then it's just our warring clan versus their warring clan. What we need to do, and what Pam is well aware needs to be done, is to return the Department of Justice not into a wingman for the president or an organization of wingmen and women for the president and not part of the judicial branch. That's not what its job is either, but an organization that applies the law, the same law to everyone, and also brings some order to this concept of prosecutorial discretion, which is utterly out of control, and hopefully at the if there's leadership at the federal level, maybe that has some effect on state and local understanding of this doctrine, which has become a terrible cancer on law and the rule of law in the United States. So, yes, I'm all in favor of Pam Bondi. And I also make one more comment. Some of the opposition I saw to Pam on the right involved policies that she might have been involved with at a time when Republicans didn't have the kind of strength that they had in Florida when she was attorney general. People have to remember, people are not necessarily their policies. Everyone ultimately has to answer for decisions that he or she makes while executing, a position. But you have to be aware of the political reality that you're operating in. The beauty about the moment that we're in now is that, gosh, we've got both houses of Congress. We've got a fairly reliable Supreme Court that listens to as many as 5 or 10 cases a year. And we might really be able to get some things done. And I think Pam is a great choice to get them done.
Yeah, and Ron, I think that's a very apt description to say we actually need to, restore justice to the Department of Justice. And this whole notion of prosecutorial discretion has been so abused. I mean, we can look no further than the Daniel Penny case out of New York. I mean, that's not the DOJ, but that is prosecutions, right? I mean, we've seen this type of weaponized lawfare for political purposes from a variety of prosecutors' offices, both on, the state and the federal level. And yet some of our friends who are on the conservative side, and we're all on the same team, they would say, okay, well, because the left has so abused their discretion and these institutions, then we're never going to get to kind of this ceasefire unless we weaponize these institutions in basically the same way, which is why I think that, Biden is even considering publicly, he's considering pardons for, people, even like Liz Cheney wasn't even part of his administration, but of course, on the January 6th committee, people like Adam Schiff and others who the Trump administration may potentially go after. And it's being looked at, of course, by the leftist media as, this is insulation from sort of a tit for tat. And we have to ensure that justice actually prevails, which is laughable, of course, because we know that wouldn't be why he would pardon. But what's your response? I mean, do you agree or disagree, or maybe somewhere in the middle, with some of our friends who would say, we kind of have to use the power of the executive branch in much the same way so that we can ultimately bring back our institutions to some, rational basis?
Look, I recognize that there's a tension here, as you do. My friend, my ex-friend, Cynical Publius, who is a lawyer and a deep-thinking guy, and not one of these sort of reactive, do what they did because they did it. But he does make an important point, which is that part of what the victims of lawfare, such as yourself, such as Donald Trump, such as, so many people whose lives and careers were ruined, including the January 6th people, the vast majority of whom did either literally nothing or trivial violations violations in the sense of like getting a ticket kind of a violation, is that the process, even if everyone ends up getting pardoned, which we're a long way from on January 6th, and even if and all the claims and charges against Donald Trump end up getting dismissed, he still will have been put through all this agony and all this expense and all this calumny, and that is part of the punishment. That's part of why should they not have to go through that also? And yeah, I get his point, and we're pretty friendly. We agree on most things, but that argument, unfortunately, I think leads us to a position where it never ends. And again, all you then have are warlords, and it becomes like a latter stage Roman Empire. Whoever's Imperial Guard member decides to step out and assassinate the Emperor, loses the Empire because he gets assassinated, and that guy becomes the Emperor for 10 minutes. It has to be done right. And the thing is, there's a lot of room. There's a great deal of room for doing things right without just becoming a mirror image of the Biden administration. And the good thing about these Trump appointments is that they are, let's put it this way, Matt Gaetz, God bless him, I have a good relationship with him. We're not friends. I'm not going to claim that. But he knows me. I know him. He's a fighter, right? He's a fighter. He did not personify the person to do this right at the Department of Justice. I believe, and this is not related to my firm's representation of President Trump, I have zero inside information either from the Trump camp or from Matt Gaetz. Just as a guy like you, you're a lot more of an insider than I'll ever be. But from my guess on the Matt Gaetz thing is, it was a feint, F-E-I-N-T, meant to give Matt a graceful way out of Congress. He was not going to be the Attorney General. That would have been the kind of give it as good as you get kind of appointment. On the other hand, Pam Bondi is a professional, conservative, and a tough law enforcement professional. She'll get the job done right. And Kash Patel, the same thing. People, the left is on him like white on rice because of his, what they deem to be extreme statements. There's nothing extreme about describing extreme conduct in accurate terms. Look at the man's record, professional record of achievement. He knows what he's doing. He is perfect for this job.
Well, and even just contrast that to the lack of professional achievement and the diversity hires of Rachel Levine and Karine Jean-Pierre and, the suitcase-stealing nuclear scientist over there. I mean, in the Biden admin, it's like they kind of lost the high ground to even ask whether Trump's nominees are qualified, in my opinion, right? But to your point, I think that for people who kind of rush to support Matt Gaetz because they appreciate how America First and how pro-Trump he's been and, his fight in Congress, and I get all of those things. I mean, he and Ginger are friends of mine, and so, I like them personally. And yet I agree with you that I think that it was a little bit of a ruse to just say, hey, let's give you a way to resign quickly and then you just don't have to go back to Congress after. And I'm a little bit surprised that Trump spent, marginal political capital. I don't think it actually hurt him at all. But, a few of the negative headlines, and he doesn't like any negative headlines on that.
Yeah.
But the contrast.
I want to pause there for a second because I had the same exact thought, which is that the scenario that I just sketched out is indeed a very un-Trump-like kind of move. It's the kind of thing he's accused of all the time, but it's the kind of thing he doesn't actually do. And if indeed he did a solid for Matt Gaetz, with the understanding that Matt wasn't going to ultimately be the Attorney General, it's probably likely that it was also partially a test to see who in the Senate is going to be a problem. Who is he going to have to worry about with respect to subsequent appointments. And I think that was very revealing.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. And there, you know, there's always multi-layers of the gamesmanship, I think, with Trump. I mean, I really would be shocked if the only reason that he did that was to give Matt a soft landing. I mean, that's not really the Trumpian way at all. I mean, as much as people could say, oh, well, you know, he protects his friends. You know, I mean, look over the history. That just ain't true. But in terms of the contrast with Pam Bondi, I think also her coming in then as the nominee, regardless of what people could say about her, maybe this was part of the play, and I don't know this, but this is, you know, a theory that I've had, is that by contrast, anything that some of the Republican senators might have held against her, because she was in consideration in the first round with Trump in the first admin, but she had that campaign acceptance from Trump, and then, you know, declined to prosecute over the whole Trump University issue, which, you know, is not really that big of a scandal at all, especially compared to, you know, the last 4 years and all of that. And I think that Trump just doesn't care at this point as much as he might have in the first term anyway. But even
Absolutely.
Something, you know, if the senators and, you know, some of the rhinos, you know, the Collins and the Murkowskis and maybe the Joni Ernst of the world want to nitpick at that now, it really does look like nitpicking it by contrast with Matt Gaetz. And so that was kind of a good potential play in that way as well. But if she is confirmed, and I think that she will be, what should be the first priorities for the DOJ under a new Trump administration, maybe to kind of reset the board for even longer term than just 4 years? Because I'm tired, Ron, of having, you know, the government be weaponized and we sort of face whiplash based on, you know, who are our political opposition or our political allies that are in office. You know, especially, I mean, not just, you know, people like me who, you know, as you've pointed out, that, you know, have been victimized by the system, but also, you know, people like just the, you know, the grandmas that are praying outside of abortion clinics. Like, that's going to be fine under the Trump administration, and it's not under the left, but, you know, we shouldn't have to base our actions and the foreseeability of a potential prosecution based on the letter description after the political office holder. That's just fundamentally un-American.
I agree. No question about that. I don't know what should be the first priority. I would say the answer is a step in the direction of transparency. I mean, look, first priority policy-wise, first priority administratively, first priority personnel-wise, because it might be that the first priority of all is to decapitate all the people who have been sending all their friends in the corporate press these text messages about how everyone in the Justice Department is about to take poison and jump off the roof and, you know, get their long-awaited jobs on K Street. Get rid of those people, because nothing is going to be achieved. Well, I mean, if we learned anything in 2016 through 2020, it's that the ability of the chief executive to set policy in executive branch agencies is directly proportional to his extent of control over the people who actually execute policy. So I would first do, and as someone with no experience in management of this sort, I don't know how you do this, but right before step one, which is to get rid of a lot of people, is step zero. Step zero is to freeze all deletion of data and destruction of records, and to bring in some outside agency that is not the FBI, it might even be a private firm, to begin the process of recovering data and documents that have been deleted since the election.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Because there is, I'm positive, a lot of illegal document destruction and data destruction going on, and we're going to need to know who's doing it and why, what's been lost, what's recoverable, and it's going to be a real management challenge. That's for sure.
Yeah, and that's really the hard part that I think Trump saw really close up in his first term is who are the good people who will get behind his goals, and who are the maybe rhinos, shall we say, or, you know, even the people who claim to not be on the side of one party or another, but clearly worked adversely to his agenda in his first term, and really cleaning up the deep state. And so that kind of gets us to DOGE. And I want to get your comments on that just briefly, because we still need to get to potential Supreme Court nominees, because I think that's a fascinating subject that really didn't come up during the election almost at all, especially compared to 2016 and even 2020. But in terms of like the Department of Government Efficiency that, you know, Elon Musk and Vivek Ramaswamy are heading up, what can they actually do that isn't just as our friend Thomas Massey posted recently on Twitter, you know, hey, DOGE, like the Constitution, it's a good idea, but you got to have some way to enforce it if you really want to implement it. So, you know, what sort of power of enforcement does the recommendations from DOGE actually carry?
That's a good question. I don't really know what kind of structure this is going to have. I mean, the fact, I don't know how this is any different from the old blue ribbon panel or advisory group that we've seen so many times and which doesn't really have enforcement power. I know that, have you heard what it is that the president has in mind structurally to make this happen without, I mean, the idea of creating a new federal agency?
I think that presumes that he's contemplated having an idea about it. You know, I mean, because when I worked for Trump, it was sort of like, you know, there's Trump and then the org sheet is and everybody else, you know, and then it's like, just go do, you know, and he would call me sometimes and be like, hey, Jenna, you know, go get this done. And I'm like, okay,
right.
How, you know what I mean? And so then I call, you know, the what I think are maybe the appropriate people. And I'm like, can I do this? Like, what is he even talking about here? And, you know, and then, and my favorite response from Jay Sekulow, who, you know, was, of course, one of the president's personal attorneys as well. He would be like, you know, well, you have a presidential, you know, executive mandate to go do this. So, you know, figure it out. And I'd be like, okay, you know, so, so that was always fun. But I think, you know, if Trump is still, you know, the same kind of MO as he was. And I think he's changed a little bit just in terms of being, you know, more eyes open, as we've discussed. But really, I think his MO of taking everybody's opinions into consideration and then sort of just being like, you know, okay, go, you know, figure it out. And that was his New York style, by the way. I mean, that was his sort of way to run his org. And he just assumed that everybody, you know, would kind of work within the process. But, you know, hey, this is our goal. Figure out how to get it done safely and legally, you know. And he approached kind of his government management that way as well. And so I think that at least from what I'm hearing as well from, you know, Vivek and then what Elon is posting, that's kind of what he's telling them to do is like, okay, first figure out kind of what the problems are. You guys just, you know, I'm empowering you to go figure it out, figure out what you want to do. And then he'll just sort of, you know, rubber stamp it maybe. So I'm not really sure that it has that much of a structure yet other than, you know, visibility of the tragedy and the quagmire that is government spending and lack of efficiency. But I think that we might see this just sort of materialize and kind of evolve over the course of, you know, the first 100 days, especially, but the first, you know, the first year even of Trump's administration. But I think that really, you know, I mean, I don't know if that's necessarily an answer, but I think that really the presumption of, you know, what can they do sort of, that's kind of the threshold question that we need to contemplate first.
So, I mean, you're right. And I do think that there's going to be a novel approach to approaching it. That's what Elon Musk brings to the table, and Donald Trump to some extent also. And the eyes widely opened Donald Trump. We're so far beyond the question of a waste of wasting money and wasted effort. The government is so phenomenally dysfunctional. I mean, this stuff that's come out about how few people actually go to work is mind-boggling.
Mm-hmm.
So there's just the target is easy and it's slow-moving and it's vulnerable. But the administrative, what's going to be interesting is to see is how they get the deep state out of the way in the process of trying to, if not eliminate, profoundly reduce the effect and the power of the deep state.
Yeah, and that raises an important question because, a lot of people have been, saying like, okay, well, Elon came in to Twitter, now X, and he just revolutionized this overnight. Like, sent out an email to employees basically saying, and I'm paraphrasing, what have you done in the last month or last week and justify your existence and, fired a bunch of people. And you can do that in a private company, generally speaking, in a way that you can't really with government employees. So are they going to contend? And I'm not an expert in employment law. I'm not sure, what your experience is with that, Ron. But, is this something that they're going to run into, this kind of government security?
It is. Yeah, there's no question. I mean, the playbook is there. They know, like, the only thing that's funny here is that I think, notwithstanding the fact that the Harris campaign had fairly accurate polling that it didn't share with donors, that Trump was going to win. And even though I think a lot of people had their heads on straight about this, the bubble, the people in the bubble, which is a lot of the people that we're talking about, really were every bit as surprised by 2024 as they were surprised by 2016. And there has been a surprising quiescence, a lack of obvious reaction in the streets and administratively, and as we're speaking here, in the corner of my eye, I see the news flash by that no less an event than the resignation of Christopher Wray has taken place.
Which is a fascinating development.
It's a fascinating development. It's part of what has to happen here. The idea of someone like Kash Patel, who I unfortunately don't know, who apparently really understands what has been done wrong, at the FBI and in the deep state. There's so much more understanding among people who matter, and that includes, of course, not only Elon and Vikesh, but of course, Trump himself and the people around him. I just wish we could know what's... There's a level of they know that we know that we know that they know that we know that they know. It's almost like the old spy versus spy,
mm-hmm.
cartoons from Mad Magazine, except that we're talking about people who are supposed to be on the same side.
Yeah, yeah. And this whole Christopher Wray thing, I'm glad you brought that up because that is, as we mentioned, a fascinating development. And I wonder if... he will be a recipient of one of the Biden pardons for any reason. And, if names on there that are being contemplated that haven't been floated in the media are, people like Alvin Bragg or, other people like Jack Smith or others. I mean, I think we still have a long way to go until January 20th, noon on January 20th, when Trump's second term kicks in and takes over. And Biden could do a lot of things before then. But let's fast forward. We'll go ahead. Comment on that, and then we'll go to the Supreme Court.
Well, it's concerning. I mean, it's a little bit silly. I mean, apparently a lot of these agencies are involved in all kinds of reclassification of jobs. The Pentagon is apparently going crazy. Everyone gets to be a four-star general. Like, all these things that people are doing that I guess to some extent could be unrolled. I guess to some extent also they are, you know, they're civil service types of actions that are subject to limited review. But it's disgusting. It's really like looking at the nomenklatura in the Soviet Union, how they operate. Dash for the trough. How fast can we stick our snouts back into the trough before, you know, it gets rinsed out again? So it's really going to be something to see.
Yeah, 100%. And, you know, again, there's still plenty of time for a lot of things to develop. But let's fast forward to after January 20th and the potential for one or more Supreme Court seats to open. Let's first start with the more conservative wing. And, you know, we are getting into the kind of aging of Thomas and Alito, who, in my opinion, are the two best bar none sitting justices. And I wish that in Trump's first term, he had nominated people who were as faithful to the original intent of the Constitution as they. And of course, you know, his three picks are far better than, you know, the lady who doesn't even know what a woman is, to say the least. But but at least for Thomas and Alito, do you think that there might be some sort of consideration of resigning so that Trump could appoint a replacement rather than being in a situation like we had with Justice Ginsburg?
I think it would be insane for them not to be thinking about that. And my understanding is, I mean, look, they're both still in good health and a very, very sound mind. They can't assume that the Senate will be a majority Republican in 2 years.
True.
On the other hand, as you point out, they are the most effective and most conservative, conservative justices among the solid 5/6 on the court. So they must realize that this is, I mean, of course they realize they're both brilliant men. They know that this is the best chance for their replacements to be people who are appropriate for them. And I mean, look, they're old. They're not as old as you can be. They're not the oldest ever. But, and you know, there is a little bit something about this phenomenon, this crystallization of the Supreme Court bar, and this idea that there are only a certain elite advocates who should be arguing and who get to argue in front of the Supreme Court, and most of them are former clerks of Supreme Court justices, and now there's this presumption that Supreme Court justices should come from that same pool of former Supreme Court justice clerks. I mean, obviously that's a great qualification for being a Supreme Court justice. You know the job, you know the issues, et cetera. On the other hand, we still have a conservative version, and that's with an asterisk because of precisely what I'm about to describe, of this Washingtonization. I mean, the idea that we tend to look to the Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit for nominees because they get a lot of federal law issues and the agency issues. That circuit, in and of itself, is a problem. That its existence and its culture are problems. And I like very much the idea of getting people from outside Washington and people who aren't necessarily graduates of Harvard, Yale, and Stanford maybe even especially, because these tend to be, look, I'm not a candidate, never will be a candidate for the Supreme Court. I understand the difference between people like me who are really good lawyers. I don't mind describing myself that way.
With I can confirm.
First-class
yes.
intellects, and people who are, genuine, superstars. The fact is, there's a lot to be said for people with practical experience, people who've tried cases, people who really have experience as being part of the legal profession, which, as we get into this really thin air world where people go to elite law schools, have elite clerkships, they spend a couple of years in elite law firms, then they either become law professors or, federal judges, and then they're on the Supreme Court. I mean, someone like Justice Kagan, she's no dummy. She's a highly intelligent person. But the law is a profession, and I think it would really be a good idea to get some people who have done some law. But these are not necessarily the people you're seeing on the list.
Yeah, and that's such a great point.
I do like the people I see. I'm not saying otherwise.
Yeah, no, that's such a great point to get, actual practitioners. Like, I'm thinking of people, like Harmeet Dillon, who very much could be a Supreme Court nominee. And I would, commend her to Trump's consideration if we get an opening. Somebody who's actually been there, done that, knows how the system works and isn't just looking at these issues in a total vacuum without understanding the real world impact, which is what I think a lot of these sort of, ivory tower people are doing. And let's talk also about, if there is a leftist on the Supreme Court that ends up vacating their seat. We have heard for, kind of a long time, though, actually, of, rumors of Justice Kagan's health, potentially. There may be other issues why she or a Sotomayor may end up resigning. I don't think that they would of their own volition during a Trump administration. But, sometimes things happen and a justice may have to resign. And so if Trump gets another appointment from the left wing of the bench, and this could be sort of a, 7-2, which in my view would hopefully be more of like a 4-3-2 in terms of conservatives, how would that change the overall composition of the bench?
That would certainly change everything. I mean, it really would depend on who ends up being the nominees. You said before you wish some of the nominees last time around had been more in the mold of Alito and Thomas. We all do. If you get those kinds of conservatives in, it gives you all kinds of flexibility, all kinds of maneuvering room. I don't want anything bad to happen to anyone, and to the credit of Justice Sotomayor, who I think is not a particularly good judge, she is, I think, on the other hand, a voice of moderation in the culture wars, and has spoken about her friendship with Justice Thomas. She's an important figure for that reason. I wish a little bit more attention would be paid to the things that she says. But, having said that, I understand that her health could be better. She's around 70, which is a reasonable age to retire. But on the other hand, I agree with you. I don't see anyone retiring who is from the left wing of the court who is able to continue functioning.
Yeah. And I agree with you. And it's so interesting that, our founders, of course, when they didn't put in term limits and it was just a lifetime appointment on the court, certainly didn't anticipate what we have now. For better or worse, it just that wasn't the contemplation. at the founding. And I think that, you know, people were sort of expected to, you know, resign if they even reached, you know, that point.
Right.
And so there's been a lot of, you know, contemplation of judicial reform, that kind of thing. But, you know, but we are where we're at. And all of that. And so I think it's going to be really interesting to see what happens and whether or not there will be strategic resignations on the bench may end up with how well the DOJ is doing under a Pam Bondi and certainly other political considerations and all of that if a justice did decide to resign. But just you know, last comment, Ron Coleman, and I appreciate your time this morning in a deep dive. You know, what should we expect from at least the Senate confirmations of, you know, Pam Bondi and others? I mean, you know, this just seems like, you know, harkening back to our conversation with Matt Gaetz, this seems like a no-brainer. I mean, do you think that Pam Bondi will have any issues with her confirmation?
No. See, she's the only thing they can say about Pam is that she is she's the kind of person that Donald Trump would nominate. You know? Well, that's right. She's untouchable.
Well, that's great, and I look forward to seeing what happens with the DOJ under her leadership. And you know, she's certainly not of the kind of the Bushy era that we saw with Barr, and hopefully is not as squidgy as the Attorney General Jeff Sessions before him. So you know, hopefully Trump is making at least a few wiser personnel decisions heading into a second term. But Ron Coleman, always I really appreciate it. Where can people reach you? Find your podcast.
Find me on X at Ron Coleman, spelled with an E, R-O-N-C-O-L-E-M-A-N. Culmination Podcast comes out every couple of weeks, and I always announce it there. So, I mean, obviously, if anyone searches for attorney or lawyer Ron Coleman, always use the word lawyer first, or else you're going to get the wrong Ron Coleman. So it's a very common name in this country, and some people have that name and are even more famous than I am. But
you're the only Ron Coleman I know, so that's shocking.
Right.
But yeah, you know, only one worth knowing, in my opinion. But you know,
thank you.
Yeah, well, great. And you know, and for those, I would highly recommend you follow Ron Coleman on X. Be aware, user beware, that there is a lot of snark and witticism, which is part of the reason that I follow Ron Coleman. But know what you're getting into there as a little bit of a disclaimer. But Ron, thanks so much. And you know, this has been On Demand with Jenna Ellis. This is our last podcast of the year. We will start back up in January. And between now and then, if you have an issue, a topic, a question or a guest that you would love to hear on demand, you can always reach me and my team, Jenna, at AFR.net. Have a wonderful Merry Christmas and Happy New Year. And to Ron as well, Happy Hanukkah. You know, all of the great, wonderful celebrations that we have over this wonderful season. And I will see you in the new year.